The following is a CNA podcast.
Welcome again to The Climate Conversations. I'm Jamie Ho. Today I'm talking to Minister for Trade and Industry Chan Chun Sing, and we'll talk about a green economy. What does it look like? What jobs and what technology will go into it? How do we build and pay for a green economy? And how far more do we really have to go in building it? Well, building this green economy is just one of the pillars of the Singapore Green Plan, which was just unveiled. And I'll talk to Minister Chan about all this. And I'll start with talking about energy and how Singapore is going to power it. Minister Chan, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me on.
Let me start with two statistics. First, the combustion of fossil fuels to generate energy, as we all know, is a major source of greenhouse gas emissions in Singapore, usually around, say, 40%. The number two source is from manufacturing industries and construction, and the majority of that direct emissions from this sector are from the combustion of primary fuels by the refining and petchem sector. Now, put that aside, let's talk about energy first. We know that we are disadvantaged when it comes to alternative, cleaner energies. That's one. Two, of all the fossil fuels that we use, we are almost entirely natural gas, and that's the cleanest of all fossil fuels. Three, we are generally doing very well in terms of energy efficiency. So the question to you, Minister, is when the government talks about energy transitions and an energy reset, and these are big words that have been used, what are we resetting and what are we transitioning to?
Okay, Jimmy, let's start from how we have built up our country over the last 50 years. Now, all this will remember that when we first became independent, our number one priority was to get enough water for ourselves. And over time, our water needs have also increased. Today, we have pretty much gotten the technology to purify water, to recycle water, and so forth. But that has just converted the dependence on external water supply to one of external energy supply. So I've always said that if water has been the challenge for the last 50 years, energy will be our challenge for the next 50 years. If we can overcome our energy challenge, then we will be able to produce enough water for ourselves. We may also be able to produce much more food for ourselves over the next 50 years. And of course, to power our industry and yet have a higher quality of life for all Singaporeans, a much greener environment for all Singaporeans. And as you mentioned, we are an alternative energy deficient country. There's only so much that we can do with renewable. The only renewable that we have is solar, and we have done the calculation, even if we cover every inch of our land area and sea area with a solar panel, we will still not be able to generate sufficient renewable energy for our survival based on the current technology. So what are we trying to do going forward for the next 50 years in terms of the so-called energy reset? Now, first, I think we will need to make sure that we continue to find more efficient ways to reduce our demand for energy, both for our homes and also for our industries. And I think there are a lot of things that we can do better for our homes, from the way we design our buildings to the way we use air conditioning to even the kind of paints that we use on our walls, the kind of materials we use for our chairs and so forth. Now, that has to do with the reduction in demand for homes. Now, on the industry side, there's also a lot of new technologies that we can embrace to reduce the demand for energy for industrial production. This includes some of the digital technologies like Industry 4.0 that better help us control our energy consumption, reduce wastage, and so forth. So that is the part that I think all of us need to embrace the mindset to what we say, go green. So all of us must have that mindset. But having said that, we need to also embrace a new generation of opportunities where the world wants to go green and there are tremendous economic opportunities in these new areas. Just to give some example, we all would like to see much more sustainable products or products that are produced in a much more sustainable ways. So there are important opportunities for us to be able to verify the sources of those products. And this is where you need to work with jurisdictions that have a high trust index, and Singapore is one of those jurisdictions. So many companies may also be attracted to base their operations out from here, whereby their production processes can be qualified to the standards that the world demands. Another area of green opportunities for growth in the new areas will be sustainable urban solutions. This includes water management, energy management, waste management, even transport design, urban design, and so forth. And just like what we have done for water, if we are able to do well for ourselves as a densely packed urban society, then many of our solutions may be exported to the rest of the world, creating more opportunities for Singaporeans, not just in Singapore, but also beyond Singapore. Those are the opportunities that I think we can aspire to in terms of growing our green economy, not just for ourselves, but also in service of the world.
Yeah.
And finally, as I was mentioning in Parliament, I think we have set a high aspirations for ourselves that we want to leave behind a greener and better environment for the next generation, that we treat it almost like our financial reserves, our social capital, and so forth. And that is where we can be a bright green spark if we have the ideas necessary to organize ourselves better, to design our housing and our work environment better, design our living systems better, then I think we can be an inspiration to the world of how a small, densely packed urban society can be the most energy efficient in terms of delivering the same quality of standard of living for the amount of resources required.
I'll definitely get into the jobs and the job opportunities later on, but still on the topic of energy, I wanted to ask another question in that, you know, 2030 isn't very far away and the government has already set quite ambitious targets, for example, in the Singapore Green Plan. The government has also pledged to halve emissions from there by 2050. So since energy is such a big part of it, eventually, if you look to 2050, what do you see as our energy mix being by that time?
Well, we hope that we will be able to up our proportion of renewable energy, and that depends on a few factors. We are already progressing at max speed possible in terms of the deployment of solar panels across the island. And someone told me that we have probably one of the densest deployment of solar panels across the city. Now, having said that, that is still not sufficient. The second thing that I think we would like to see is a breakthrough in the current solar panel technology. We all know that today, based on the best-in-class technology, the solar panel is at about 20 plus minus 5% efficiency for the current generation of technology. So if there is a breakthrough, then for the same amount of surface area, we can actually collect more solar energy than is possible. But there's also a natural limit based on our geographical size. The second set of things that perhaps we can look at is to see whether we can import clean energy from other sources. And there are some of these possibilities if we can tap into the regional grid. Now, recently, I think you all might have heard about the plan for us to link up to the regional grid called the Laos, Thai, Malaysian, Singapore grid. And that means that technically we can import energy or electrons all the way from the hydropower projects as far away as Laos or some of the other green energy projects in Thailand or Malaysia. So that will allow us more option. A third possibility that we have heard people talk about commercially is the idea to bring in power all the way from Northern Territories in Australia. But that is a technically very challenging and very exciting project. In the world today, the longest undersea cable is about maybe 800 kilometers long, but this would require a cable that is about 4,000 kilometers long. So it will have to have quite some technological breakthroughs. Having said that, I think while we can try to import energy from the regional grid or we can try to develop more solar power for ourselves, one of the challenges that have to come with this is the fact that solar is intermittent. And we need to develop the corresponding energy storage solutions in order for us to cater to the peak and trough of the solar energy supply. So the battery technology or other alternative ways of storing energy will become very important if we are to rely more on a renewable energy. And we must also look into the greenness of battery technology, as you say, because many of the current battery technology will require some of the rare earth and heavy metals that may not be as environmentally friendly as some people might think it to be. So we have to look at it as an entire ecosystem in order to really assure ourselves that our energy supply can become greener in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, we know, for example, even if we look even further into alternatives, we know the Singapore government's position on things like nuclear energy. But when you look at things like hydrogen, are you optimistic in terms of the technology that Singapore is able to contribute and look into ourselves to make things like hydrogen potentially viable in Singapore?
Yes, we are looking at that very closely, and there's some promising starts in various parts of the world. So we are keeping close tab on that to see whether hydrogen can be an alternative fuel. Now, of course, if hydrogen becomes a possibility, then it will also require a new logistic network to provide the hydrogen around Singapore and into Singapore. And that means that there's also great opportunities for us to be a distribution hub in the region. That's why we're monitoring this closely. There are projects in Australia, there are projects in Japan that people are trying to use hydrogen as an alternative fuel. And if it comes about, perhaps in the next 15 or 20 years, we will also be able to grow a new sector in the hydrogen economy.
Talk about refining and petchem, something which I alluded to in the introduction to our discussion. Singapore is one of the five largest refining centers in the world. You know, oil makes up about 70% of our total merchandise exports in 2019. We're also one of the world's leading chemical hubs. Most are located on Jurong Island. And this system itself, people have said, contributes nearly 3% of Singapore's GDP in 2015. Now, before we even get to the question of emissions and climate change, people are also now talking about the world having reached peak oil or peak demand. As a matter of overall structure of the Singapore economy, I was thinking, are you looking at repositioning Singapore's entire dependence on this sector and sort of moving it slightly away only because people are talking about peak oil, peak demand?
Well, actually, Jamie, even before this current word sustainability becomes fashionable in Singapore, that transition that you talk about has already started many years ago. If we look at the oil majors that are present in Singapore, they have already started some of the transition even before this Paris Treaty comes about. Maybe I can share some of this transition. Now, the first transition that oil majors have started is that they know that increasingly they will go into cleaner way of producing the same old products. And if we look at all the production plants in Singapore, perhaps less one, they are all in the top quarter of the cleanliness, if we might say that. So they are using the best-in-class technology to produce the same products at a much more efficient, much more cleaner ways than elsewhere. That means that if the product is not produced here and produced somewhere else in other parts of the world for the same amount of product, for the same type of product, they would have been produced in a much less efficient and much less green way than what we are able to do. So that's the first step that we have done over the years. The second step that have been done over the years is that actually they are now progressing more and more into specialty chemicals and less of the previous petroleum type of products. That is a higher value add, much cleaner. And they are also finding new ways to combine the sustainability agenda with the previous efficiency agenda. So in that sense, you can see that as we go forward, Singapore will also be much more into the specialty chemicals that are produced much more safely, much more green, much more efficiently. And that will allow us to make that transition towards a much cleaner economy, not just for ourselves, but also in service of the global demand. So these are some of the changes that are already underway. And I'm sure the oil majors will continue to transit their production in accordance to the world demand or even ahead of the world demand. So like recently, you might have heard that this IMO, the International Maritime Organization, requiring a transition of the type of fuel that the ships need to use. And in fact, Singapore is at the forefront of meeting that demand for the new generation of fuel as well. Likewise, we have also seen the aviation industry experimenting with different fuel mix that are much greener for the aviation industry. And again, Singapore is tapping into those opportunities to make those transition. So I think we have mapped out a plan for the next 20 to 30 years on how we see our petrochemicals industry evolving. And I would simplistically say less petrol, more chemicals and more specialty chemicals that are much greener, much more efficient than before.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. So you spoke at COS about stepping up decarbonization and therefore transforming Jurong Island into this sustainable energy and chemicals park. I suppose this is the crux of where the action will be in the coming years then. Describe for me then how this sustainable energy park is going to look like. Have you spoken and discussed what this sustainable energy park is going to look like with the majors currently at Jurong Island?
Oh, yes, definitely. Because the oil majors, they all have their own plans and they all have their own scenario planning to help them drive their own development, R&D and also production processes. I would say that even without us having to nudge them, they know that the world wants greener products, cleaner products, and they are already well on their way to do this. That's why BP, they have called themselves a beyond petroleum in the past, right? So they actually are very serious. So I think when we look at Shell, when we look at ExxonMobil, I think they are all very serious about developing a new generation of products. And I have visited some of their plants to see their research, and they are investing quite a lot of money into R&D to develop a new generation of products that are much more sustainable and much more greener.
I'm glad you mentioned Shell and ExxonMobil. They have been in the news recently, and I'll use this segue to talk about jobs. Mm. When you see what's been happening and their announcements and restructuring and layoffs, does that concern you? Are we going to see more friction as that entire industry evolves internationally, and therefore as they flow down, Singapore's job sort of opportunities there are going to change as well?
Not really, because Jamie, if we look at the economy, including petrochemical industry, there will be a constant churn. And because Singapore is not the cheapest place to put all your production here, they will always concentrate the highest value at production in Singapore because our wages are higher than the rest. So there will always be a churn whereby some of the lower wages people might be displaced, but we constantly seek to create better jobs for our people at a higher ranges of the wage ladder. And that must be an ongoing process for us. This applies not just to the oil and gas industry, but it applies across the entire industry. So sometimes, you know, you hear firms saying that, oh, why is the S-Pass criteria is going up or the EP criteria is going up? That is actually part of the churn for us to keep pushing the wages up in our economy so that given our size, we will have the most highest paid jobs possible for our people, so that we can keep churning the thing, because we cannot compete with other people based on price or size. Other bigger countries will definitely beat us in this game.
Yes.
So we have to be competing on the basis of the quality of our products, the efficiency of our system, and also our speed to market. So if we can continue to invest in our people, continue to invest in our processes, then we can be sure that our people will continuously be able to get the higher paying jobs in a rapidly churning market.
Yeah. You know, the narrative about climate change and cutting emissions and things like that, it's always almost negative more often than not. And, you know, people talk about trade-offs and job losses, true to some extent. But in terms of jobs, therefore, I mean, you spoke a little bit about this earlier. Paint an optimistic picture for us in terms of the jobs that a green economy can provide. I mean, when we looked at the US and Joe Biden was running for president, he was talking about 10 million clean energy jobs. That kind of narrative, I suppose, tries to change the perspective that people may have. So do you think we're on that road? Do you think we can paint a similarly sort of positive narrative on the jobs available in this green economy?
I think we can, but I must first say that it'd be very artificial for us to try and divide what is called clean or not clean jobs. Our aim is not cast in that way. Mm-hmm. Our goals are actually cast in the following way, if I may. Mm-hmm. The first is that I think we want every job to be a cleaner job over time. That means the same production, whether is it pet chem, whether is it semicon, whether is it biomedical, we want every of our products and processes to be greener as we go along. And we want our companies and workers to be able to embrace the new technologies to produce products that are cleaner and greener. So that's one part of it. The second part of it is that actually, as we were discussing just now, there are many new growth opportunities that perhaps currently don't exist, and that will create more new opportunities for our people in the green industry. So this includes, for example, carbon credits trading. This includes urban solutions management, from energy to water to waste to even transport and urban designs, where we can export our expertise overseas, creating more opportunities for our people. We won't put a target to say that we want X number of green jobs, because actually our target is every job can become a greener job, and there are many more green jobs that today don't yet exist but can come about. And if we have the right skills and the right capabilities in our companies, we will be able to seize those opportunities against the global competition.
That's a nice way to put it. And maybe I'll transition to another topic which is close to the heart of many people who watch this discussion on climate change. And this is about the carbon tax or carbon price. You know, in 2017, when DPM Heng Swee Keat first announced this, the intention to introduce it, right, by 2019, he said that the carbon tax is the most economically efficient and fair way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Do you stand by this, that it is the most economically efficient and fair way?
Yes, this can be the most efficient and fair way for us to all transit to a greener economy on the conditions that we all have a clear, transparent and a fair carbon price. And let me just explain this. We all know that, you know, Singapore is just a tiny fraction of the global economy. And so while we want to price the carbon externalities right, we actually need to move in tandem with the rest of the world. Now, in the rest of the world, there are many countries with different practices in terms of their carbon pricing. Some of them have higher carbon price, but they have all kinds of offset, which means that the effective carbon price is not as high as they claim it to be. Then that causes all kinds of distortion to people's investment decisions and production decisions. Now, of course, as a small country, what we hope is that the whole world can come together and embrace a common carbon price, because the externalities are actually shared. But having said that, we all know how difficult it is for the whole world to come and agree on a common carbon price, or even agree on a common mechanism to price carbon. So what we have to do is, based on our sense of stewardship for our country, and yet at the same time maintain our competitiveness vis-a-vis other economies, so that it doesn't have a negative impact on the prospect of our businesses and the job prospects of our people going forward. And yet, at the same time, a third dimension is that we have to watch the technology very closely to make sure that we nudge our industries to adopt the best-in-class technologies wherever possible. With all these considerations behind, we will make sure that whenever we review the carbon price, we will make sure that while we fulfill our responsibility to future generations, we will also take into account the impact on jobs and the cost of living for the current generation.
I'm glad you said that, because I was just looking at, again, your speeches that you made in Parliament recently, and I'll use that quote. You say that when we review our carbon prices, we must be very conscious of the impact that this will have on our current and future competitiveness, and the consequent impacts on the jobs and livelihoods of all Singaporeans. DPM Heng has already mentioned that he will take a year to review the trajectory of the carbon price. But when looking at it in the context of what you said, using that quote, what does it say about the number of jobs that are currently tied to sectors that are sort of carbon intensive, where if you tweak the carbon price a little bit, as you say, there will be consequent impacts? Going back then to the question of jobs, is there a concern that you have between the link between carbon price competitiveness and then jobs?
Certainly. That's why we have to watch this very closely. What is the trajectory of the carbon price? We will have to depend on the pace of technology development. It will have to depend on the pace which other countries are adopting their carbon pricing mechanism. So that it's not just about what we do in Singapore, but it's also about what people do elsewhere. And I don't think when we adjust the carbon price that only some sectors will be involved, because all sectors will be impacted in some way. The question is one of magnitude rather than whether they are or they are not impacted. So, for example, supposing if one day we have to adjust the carbon price, I think one of the impact on that will be on electricity prices.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Given that all industries and all homes use electricity, so everyone will be impacted in some sense. So that is why we have to do this very carefully to watch our competitiveness and the impact on jobs, while at the same time fulfilling our responsibilities. And on the other hand, we must watch the competition, because if we adjust our carbon price too high, too fast, the rest of the others are not adjusting theirs, then first of all, I think there will be very minimal impact on the environment beyond Singapore. Number two, then we would be losing our competitiveness vis-a-vis other people. Then it also depends on the technology as to whether our industries can make those transitions within the time frame that we are thinking of. It must be a very carefully calibrated exercise to balance all these different considerations.
The picture that you paint is therefore of quite a delicate balance. And as I conclude our chat, I want to therefore talk about trade-offs in this balance, right? Because trade-offs is a term which we heard quite often through the recent debates on the budget and the Committee of Supply. The point is this, and I'm thinking, climate action in the end, as you alluded to, and I agree with, that it cannot be done on the cheap. There is going to be a price, right? Whether it's carbon tax and then whether or not eventually higher electricity prices, that will come. So is this an eventuality that you think Singaporeans will have to start getting used to in the further name of environment? Singapore has already paid attention to this in the past, but to pay even further attention to it in the future, somehow or other, we need to start getting used to the fact that Singaporeans and the world will have to pay for this.
Yes, definitely. I think there will be some trade-offs. But, you know, in the usual spirit of Singapore and Singaporeans, we always try to have our cake and eat it and trying to have the best of both worlds, right?
Yeah.
And in some sense, it is possible. If we think back on our journey for the last 50 over years of nation building, in some sense, actually, we have been ahead of the curve in having to pay this price. Let me just give an example. You know, we all are familiar with the Singapore Cityscape, our urban planning guidelines. Very early on, we have insisted that you must plant trees along the sidewalks and so on and so forth. You must have certain measures to make sure that your buildings are energy efficient and so forth. Now, compared to many other countries, people will say that, oh, you know, the cost of building in Singapore is so much higher. And that shows that actually we have already been trying to balance our environmental considerations with the quality of life that we want to have, and we have been paying for that in some sense over all these years. You look at the amount of land that we set aside for greenery, for parks, the nature reserves, and so forth. That also is a price that, in inverted commas, that we pay for making sure that the next generation have as good, if not a better, environment than us. If you look at the amount of resources that we spend in terms of greening our parks, having park connectors, upgrading our rivers, reservoirs, and so forth, all those are also investments that we have made, and so-called the prices that we have paid for us to have the current environment that we have. Now, going forward, the question then becomes, are we going to have to pay more? And if so, what can we do such that we can have the best of both worlds? So I think it has to be seen from both the demand and supply perspective. Now, if we can become much more energy efficient in our residential needs, in our industrial needs, then we would actually be able to save on the energy, and then we might not have to pay the type of prices that we otherwise would have to pay if we are much less efficient and less productive and less green in our solutions. On the other hand, then we have to find new ways to generate energy that are much more efficient. And if we can have those new ways, then we can try to mitigate the prices that we have to pay in terms of the environmental agenda and yet achieving a certain high quality of life that we all desire. So I don't think it's entirely mutually exclusive to say that we want a higher quality of life, we want a greener life, and yet at the same time, we want to mitigate the cost of living. The question is one of how can we adopt the best-in-class technology, new methods of production, new ways of living, new lifestyle that embrace the green agenda, which is much more resource and energy efficient, and yet at the same time, we find new ways to produce this at a much greener ways. And if we can do this at scale, then Singapore, having pioneered the solutions, can export the solutions to the rest of the world, and that will also add to our economies of scale in terms of the methods that we have. Oh, you know, I won't be too pessimistic to say that it is a binary option between one versus the other. Mm-hmm. The solutions are definitely not mutually exclusive, and we can, in the best of Singapore's spirit, to find ways that can combine the best of both worlds.
If I were to use this last question to talk about the trade-offs in a more personal manner, maybe for you, how are trade-offs discussed within cabinet? I imagine you will have one view, other ministers in other portfolios may have another view. When a final decision is made, where does it usually lean towards?
Well, I think the nice thing about cabinet is not so much as to whether we take a certain view because we are responsible for a certain portfolio. So as the saying goes, where we stand doesn't depend on where we sit, or where we sit doesn't depend on where we stand.
Okay.
Actually, when it comes to cabinet, we all take a collective view, and we must demonstrate that perspective from the best interests of our country and our people. So if you ask us how are we going to decide on this, there are a few quite simple guidelines. First, we have to ask ourselves, what is in the best interest of Singapore for the long term? For every decision that we make, will it provide Singaporeans with a better living environment for the long term? Will it create better job and business opportunities for our people and businesses for the long term? So it's always about the long-term interests of the country. The second perspective that we will always take is that beyond the long-term goals for our people and our country is how can we help our businesses and people make the necessary transitions, acquire the necessary capabilities so that we can get onto the long-term trajectory as best as we can with minimum disruption as far as possible. So these are some of the guiding principles that we always consider in cabinet. The long-term interests of our country and people, once we have decided that that's the long-term goal, how do we overcome the short to medium-term challenges to get ourselves onto that long-term trajectory as soon as possible?
Minister Chan Chun Sing, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thanks again for listening to Climate Conversations. This podcast is supported by the Sabana Jurong Group, building cities, shaping lives. And it's also been recorded using Sennheiser. Stay up to date on CNA's coverage of climate change on cna.asia. It's all on the orange tab. You can also find this and other CNA podcasts on our website and on iTunes and Spotify. The team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, Lin Tzu Ling, and Erin Low. I'm Jamie Ho. Till next week.